ring that my mom warned me about years ago, telling me this was the one thing that would be the same for me, exactly the same, because of biology. She said, "There will be a stirring, and it will make you do dangerous things." It took many years and many conversations for me to understand that I was the result of a stirring, and a boy from her high school whose family moved away the second they found out about me and how, basically, I was part of the whole shitstorm that ruined her life. I tried to fight it, but I still feel something burning in my gut. An impulse to whisper in his ear, "Just keep driving away from this place, away from the decision I forced us to make. Just hold me again, touch me like you did that night, and never, ever stop." In the fastest flash that sweeps through me, more like a feeling than a thought, I imagine us together the way I've imagined it before. I've stored away the kisses and the touches and the things Keller has told me, things about how it is when you're with a boy, when Keller and I have sat beneath the hand of God on the hood of her car and I've begged her to tell me, and she's relented. "Only if you drink a beer with me," she always says. Sometimes my mind doesn't settle easily when I'm thinking through new information. It spins like a washing machine, faster and faster until something turns it off. Beer turns it off better than tapping my fingers or anything else I've found. And Keller knows this because she's my best friend, and that's the sort of thing best friends know about you. I know things about her, too. I always drink the beer, and maybe even take a drag of her cigarette until the machine stops spinning. And then she tells me about his tongue brushing her ear, and his hand on her breast, and then sliding down between her legs, and then when they're naked, lying together, before, during, after, the oneness of them, the passion, the love, the desire. Levi is a strong boy, a man, really, with olive skin and dark, earnest eyes, and Keller says he holds her so tight she has no choice but to surrender completely, to let go of everything and give in to him, letting him lead in some wild but beautiful dance. You just disappear, Charlie, into each other. You become one. Her face fills with wonder when she tells me this, like she's just seen a UFO land in front of her, like it's a miracle that no one else has ever experienced. And from the way Levi looks at her when they're together, I know they both believe it. They believe in this kind of love. And they don't care if it's just because of Keller's storybook face and curvy body, or Levi's chiseled cheekbones and broad shoulders, or if she'll have to have a baby if there's an accident, or if the baby will steal their dreams the way I stole my mom's. Ian taught me about irony, and there is no greater irony in the world than how the best feeling I've ever felt comes from the most dangerous thing I could ever do. Still, in these moments with Keller, when my mind stops spinning, I forget the great irony and all I want is to believe the way she believes. I want to step inside her body and feel what it feels like to believe that way. When she speaks of it, I want it to be true. I want her to believe in love the way she does, as badly as I want to get out of this place. Because each time I imagine it for myself, with Ian, even after a beer and a cigarette with my best friend, listening to the cars on the interstate just beyond the bushes, their drivers may be seeing the hand of God, but not us, because we are hidden and lost for this one moment. Even then, and even right now, I hear my mom telling me it will steal my dreams, and then the love will die. That kind of love isn't real. As hard as I try, I can't prove her wrong, so I know I will never have what Keller has. And so Keller must have it and hold it for the both of us. And I feel like I would fight to the death to let her keep it. One night, Ian and I decided we couldn't be together like that. We decided because I decided. And now all that's left is this. A sigh, the silence, regret. Me in the back of his police car. That horrible night, together in the bed of his truck, under the hand of God, still playing in my head. Chapter 5.
See? I told you no one would be here on a Sunday night.
You were right.
Don't sound so surprised. I'm right some of the time, you know. Like about Mr. Drew giving us that pop quiz Friday. Ugh, such a dick move. And last period, too. Want a Coke?
Sure. It was totally shitty. And I wasn't surprised. I mean, I was about the pop quiz, but not about you being right. I know you're right sometimes. Like about Jeannie Carmichael liking Henry Rudolph. Yeah. I could have sworn you were wrong about that.
Well,
she called him a jerk right in front of all her friends. I heard her.
Girls do that sometimes. Guys too.
Why? What's the point of that? Then no one can trust what you say.
They do it in case the other person doesn't like them back. Then they can deny liking them and not feel stupid, you know?
I guess. I always wondered. I've seen it before, but never really got it. It didn't seem important enough to find out.
Where did you see it before?
Season 5, episode 9 of ER New York. There was a new doctor who liked one of the paramedics, but he was too cute for her. So she said she didn't like him when she really did.
Right. Same thing.
Have you ever done that?
Exactly, but I have pretended to only like someone as a friend.
Who?
You really don't know.
Keller? It's Keller, isn't it? Is that why you wanted to come here with me on a Sunday night to tell me you like Keller?
What? No.
If I were a guy, I would like her.
Charlie, no. It's not Keller. I mean, Keller is great. I mean, she's beautiful and sweet, but it's not her.
But you don't have any other friends who are girls.
Yes, I do.
Why are you looking at me like that?
Like what?
Like the way people look right before one of them kisses the other one.
You're the genius, aren't you? You tell me why I'm looking at you like that. And what girl's my friend that I might have been pretending not to like as more than a friend?
Wait.
You're tapping. Are you okay?
I'm nervous.
Just take a breath. You'll figure it out.
No, I'm nervous because I did just figure it out.
Nervous in a good way, because you feel the same, or a bad way, like you wish you didn't know, because...
I don't know. It just feels strange.
It's supposed to feel strange, but a good strange.
I feel like I'm at the top of a roller coaster.
You like roller coasters, so that's good, right?
But I don't think I'm supposed to like this kind.
Can I?
Can you what?
Can I kiss you? Do you want me to kiss you?
I don't know. I mean, yes. Okay. Just do it. Kiss me.
Does it feel good?
I don't know. I mean, yes. I mean, I think so. How is it supposed to feel?
It's supposed to feel like you want more. Like you never want it to stop.
Mm.
because of how we feel about each other.
But I don't know how I feel. I don't know anything.
Charlie?
What?
Look, I know this sounds crazy because we've been friends for so long and everything, but I think I love you. I know I love you as a friend, but I think I'm in love with you. And I haven't told you because I didn't want to freak you out and then have you not be my friend anymore, but I do. I love you. And when you love someone, you want to kiss them and then do other things. Eventually, when you're both ready.
I know all of that. I know what happens when you're ready. Mm-mm. Wait, stop. What? Just let me think.
Okay. I'm sorry. I don't want you to be uncomfortable. It's okay if you want to take it slow, or if you don't feel the same. We can forget this ever happened, and...
No! I don't want to forget. I do feel the same.
Oh.
I think a part of me has always known, since we played on the monkey bars in fourth grade.
Wow. Okay. That's good. I mean, I'm relieved. I thought maybe it was just me.
Wait, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I keep stopping. It's just, it's my mom. It's all the things she's told me and all the things I know and that you should know, that everyone should know.
What things? We're just kissing, Charlie, that's all. Mm. It can just be that. Mm-mm. For as long as you want. What? What is it? What's wrong, Charlie?
It's just kissing now. But you even said that kissing leads to other things, and I can't do those other things.
What are you talking about?
Did you know that 87% of people in Sawyer were born in Sawyer? 92% don't have a college education. 52% live below the poverty line. Women make 23% less money than men for the same jobs, and the teen pregnancy rate is 30% higher than the national average. That's what love does to people. That's all because of love.
Stop, okay? Just stop. What do all these statistics have to do with you and me?
If I love you, I'll never leave. I'll never go to college, and you'll never go to college, and we'll just be part of those statistics.
But
it's love that does that. Love ruins everything.
No, Charlie, that's not true. Love, love is everything. It's the only thing.
My mom says that love is a trick God plays on us, and she knows because it happened to her, but it's all around us. Just look at the people here.
No offense, but your mom is crazy, Charlie.
It's not just her. It's the numbers. Numbers don't lie. Everything else is a lie.
Okay, so would it be different if I told you I would go with you to college? That I will promise you right here and right now that we won't let any of that happen to us? If we both go to college, then there's no reason for either of us to stay here. Maybe we could even go to schools that are close to each other, and we can be in love somewhere else.
Ian, you know you'll never leave Sawyer. You'll never leave because of the orange Buick. And if you never leave, and I love you, then I'll never leave. That's what happens.
What does the orange Buick have to do with anything? Do you really think I'm going to spend my entire life looking for the car that killed my dad? Don't you think I know what he would think of me if I did that?
I think maybe you believe that, but I don't think it's true. And what about your mother? Are you really going to leave her?
I
Be honest. Please.
That's really what you think of me?
I'm sorry, but yeah. Since I've known you, that's what sits in front of your mind. Like one of those cartoon thought bubbles.
You're wrong. That's not all I think about. I mean, maybe that's all you think about, because once you get something in your head, like this thing about love, you can't get it out. Maybe you're the one who can't stop.
That's not true.
So what? So now I'm a liar?
In a way, because you're lying to yourself.
And you're lying to yourself if you think you can go through life and never let yourself love anyone.
Maybe you should just take me home now.
Charlie, wait. I'm sorry I said that about things getting stuck in your head.
It's fine. Just take me home.
I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe we're not going to be together just because of your mother's theory about love.
It's not a theory. Theories are hypothetical. It's a fact. Because it's based on numbers, and numbers don't lie, Ian. People lie. Even if they only lie to themselves.
Chapter 6. My mom's not happy she's been dragged down to the police station. Today is Saturday, and that's the one day she has help with her boys, because Dusty is home. On Sundays, he plays golf. But what really has her in a tiff is that they've messed with her daughter. I hear her before I see her as I sit in a chair in the hallway. My mom has a loud and commanding voice after being Mrs. Dusty Madison for 7 years.
You have no right! This is a travesty! My husband is a lawyer. He's on the town council. Someone will pay for this.
She turns the corner, sees me, and stops. She's in her tennis clothes, which means she got pulled from her game with her friends at their club. We've come a long way from our shitty apartment. She says nothing, but gives me a serious look that says, I'm here now, you see? And I'm taking control, so you just be a good girl, Charlie, and sit there quietly. A uniformed officer puts us in a small interview room with a fake wood table and metal chairs. It's not intimidating, like Law and Order or any cop show, really. There are no two-way mirrors or cups with bitter coffee or overflowing ashtrays. It's just a room. She makes one more declaration while she has the chance.
You have no idea how sorry you're going to be.
I am her cub, and she is my mama bear. It must be primal, the way I want to let her fight to protect me, because I can't stop it. And the feeling becomes a spoonful of glass making its way down my throat and into my stomach. This is the same woman who put things into my head and took other things out, like a brain surgeon performing some creepy lobotomy. And now I can't love the one person who wanted to love me. And now he's not my boyfriend. He's barely even my friend. Now I'm just a girl who had to ride in the back of his police car. They leave us alone while they wait for the detective to become available. My mom sits beside me, pretending to be calm now, like she's done this before and knows what to do, even though we both know that's not true.
Don't say a word, not one word, you hear me?
I open my mouth to say, yes, I understand, but she shushes me before I get out a single syllable. She is not kidding about not saying one word. A woman comes in. Her name is Detective Pitfield. She smiles and asks us if we want something to drink, and my mom says no for both of us. The detective sits across from us.
You're Charlie Hudson, correct? She asks.
But my mom puts an end to things right then and there.
My daughter wants a lawyer, she says.
Detective Pitfield sighs with frustration. My mom has this effect on people. Did you bring a lawyer with you? My mom shrugs and waves her arm in front of her. Do you see a lawyer? I shift in my seat. The detective senses my discomfort. I think she must wonder if it's because I know something about Coop's death, or because my mom is this woman she now wants to strangle, and I've had to live with her for 17 years. Your daughter is not under arrest, she says. So we can leave? Technically, you can leave, but we do have some questions, and I think you'll want to know why. Can you just wait another minute? She excuses herself politely and leaves the room. See, my mom says to me. I don't do so much as part my lips this time. When Detective Pitfield returns, she has a man with her, and he has a folder. He opens it and slides it across the table so it sits before both of us. Inside is a photo of me at the Triple S. What is this? My mom asks. But I know exactly what it is. My seesaw begins to tilt. Hot head. Hot head. Coop had that camera at the store, and now I'm in a heap of shit. The man's name is Detective Slater, and he's the one who answers my mom. It's a still shot of digital surveillance from the dining area of the sandwich shop last night. It was recovered from Mr. Cooper's home computer. We both lean in to study the image. It's grainy, but unmistakable. It's me, crouched beneath the metal counter where customers stand to place their orders. The same counter I stood behind all morning. You were at the store last night, Charlie, hiding under the counter. You stayed there for 1 minute and 42 seconds. He pauses to observe my mom's silence and shock, which she tries to cover with a haughty expression. I don't know what else to call it when she does this, leaning back in her chair, arms folded, head askew with a toss of her hair as her lips smirk and her entire face relaxes like she's beyond bored. I've seen it 100 times on The Real Housewives. My mother should have her own show. She does it so well. Detective Slater turns the photo to reveal another one beneath it. Again, it's me, and I look scared. You can flip through them if you want. Charlie, you were there last night, and it's pretty clear from the footage that you were listening to something unpleasant. I stare as he turns the pages, slowly. I can't bear to even touch them as I see myself. My face curious, concentrating, listening. My hands covering my ears, trying to block it out. I wince. My mom's expression cements because she's fighting against her anger, realizing that I didn't tell her about this. In my defense, I've been really busy today. Also, in my defense, I cannot think about last night. I cannot talk about last night. I have made promises to myself and to others, and I will not break them, not for anyone or anything. I don't see how any of this is relevant. Wasn't Coop found near his house? On the street by his car? It's been all over the news, my mom says. Detective Pitfield leans back, crosses her arms just like my mom. I know what's coming next. We have reason to believe the body was moved. My mom holds her face steady, except for a slight tremor at the corners of her mouth, like what happens when you have to smile too long for a school photo. She doesn't look at me. She doesn't look at the detectives. She reaches up and neatly stacks the photos of her daughter hiding beneath the counter at the Triple S last night, slides them back into the folder, and closes the cover. Then she pushes it back to where it came from, across the table. She holds her Real Housewives expression, but I now see something else there, too. Something she told me about years ago. Before she had the right to have that kind of expression. Before Dusty saved us. It had to do with a snow globe she had growing up. She'd thrown it against our bedroom wall when we still lived with my grandparents. It shattered into a million pieces, and Granny screamed at her through our door for what felt like hours. She told me that Sawyer was a snow globe, like the one she broke. The people were glued to the bottom, and all they knew were the same snowflakes that kept falling on their heads. And they liked it that way. They didn't want different snowflakes. Not like her, and not like me. She told me she hated Sawyer and all the people glued to the floor, and she never planned to stay here. She'd had big dreams. And she's scared now, because they have something on us. On me. She's scared because no matter what she's done to be a snowflake that belongs here and to make me one, she never will be. And neither will I. And she doesn't know what they'll do if they have the chance to get rid of us. The TV show plays on as my mom says her lines. My daughter wants a lawyer, and this interview is over. Chapter 7. My mom calls Dusty the second the detectives leave. She walks to the corner where she thinks I can't hear her whispering to him about how I might have done something terrible, and can he come down here right away? He must have said something about the boys and what would he do with them, because she gets frustrated and tells him to call someone from his office then. She hangs up and sits down, and I look at her but don't ask about the lawyer because she told me not to say one word and that's what I'm doing, but I can see she's not happy. I think then that if Dusty is a lawyer with his own firm and we can't get a lawyer to come and help us right now, then we're not really that far away from our shitty apartment after all. Come on, she says to me. We're going to the bathroom. Why? I ask. She looks at me like I don't know a single thing about any single thing and says, to buy time. In the bathroom, my mom checks beneath all the stalls, then takes me by both arms, squeezing them tight. You have to tell me everything that happened last night, she says. Oh, I can't believe this. I can't believe this. She releases me, then goes into a stall to pee. She doesn't stop talking. She talks and pees at the same time. I mean, a murder, Charlie, a moved body, for Christ's sake. She comes out again and washes her hands. She takes four paper towels from the dispenser, pulling each one hard, like they're going to put up a fight. Sometimes I still don't know what to do with you. The door opens, and we both turn to see who's joined us. I think I hear my mom swear under her breath, or maybe she just says, Jesus Christ, which is one of the worst things you can say in our town. Worse than the F word. But my mom says it all the time, and with different configurations of the Lord's name. Christ, Jesus, Jesus Christ, and the longest one, Jesus H. Christ. No one knows what the H stands for, although there are a bunch of theories that I looked up once because she says it so often and it makes Dusty so angry. They're all long and boring. Coop's wife, Regina, stops and looks at us. Her face is red from crying. Tears drip down her chin. Charlie, she says. Then she takes three steps toward us. And as my mom watches, she pulls me into her arms and sobs right in my ear. It startles me, and I stay stiff as a board until it ends. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. She was always nice to me when she came to the Triple S, which was once a week, even though her version of nice was to speak to me like I was a child, slowly and with simple words. She even raised her voice, like maybe my lopsided seesaw had also impacted my hearing. Regardless, I never liked Regina Cooper. Her mind always seemed stuck in some kind of groove, like when it snows around my mom's car and no matter how hard you press on the gas, the wheels spin in place. The world was what it was, and she was winning, and no one was going to take that away. Still, she used to say I was like a second daughter to her and Coop, so I think she's expecting me to cry with her. She didn't know the first thing about her husband. If she did, she wouldn't expect me to cry over his death. and if she ever got unstuck from her groove, not one single tear would drip from her chin either. My mom finishes drying her hands and stands beside me. "We're sorry for your loss," she says. Regina pulls away and says something she's supposed to, like, "Thank you," or, "Yes, it's been very hard." But she doesn't look at my mom, even as my mom glares at her. I make a note. My mom hates Regina Cooper. And Regina Cooper seems wary of my mom. I don't know why, and feel angry with myself that I never noticed their dynamic before. I think then maybe it goes back to high school, because that's the last time they were in the same corner of our snow globe. My mind starts to spin with theories. Regina wipes her face with the back of her hand. "The IRS came to the house this morning and wanted to take things before the police could even investigate. When I refused, they said they would come back with a warrant. So I'm here trying to get someone to stop them. And poor Lillian. I had to leave her with my mother, who drove up from Pittsburgh. It's just so unbelievable." Lillian is Regina and Coop's 12-year-old daughter. She's a brat, and no one at the Triple S likes her. But what would you expect? Apples don't fall far from their trees. The best they can do is try to roll away. Regina starts to cry again. "Yes," my mom says, even as she squints her eyes. "That must be very hard for both of you." Regina goes on then about how, in addition to the IRS, the police have been to her home and all the stores. "They thought it was a robbery at first, but he had his phone and cash in his wallet, and they didn't take his truck. It's valuable with all the detailing he had done for hunting." More sobs. I get her a paper towel while my mom watches. I could be wrong, but no, I'm not wrong. She's enjoying this. "He was good to his people, at all of his businesses. He was so kind. Wasn't he, Charlie? Now they're saying he had a fight with someone yesterday, but they won't say who, and they're asking about his records, and the IRS is involved, and it's as if they're blaming him, like something he did might have made someone want to kill him." As a new wave of crying overtakes her, I think to myself that they won't find anything. Coop didn't want Nora keeping records, not even the Excel spreadsheet to track the sales and inventory that I created. Coop handwrote the register reports every day, on paper, then deleted them from the machine. He always took the papers with him when he left. Nora said our food costs dropped after we started to use my Excel model. She told me she was going to show Coop. She thought he would be proud of me. But Nora was wrong. Coop told her to stop using the spreadsheet and to go back to doing what she was doing. That was the day Nora started locking the door to the office and staying late after Coop was sure not to come back. Over time, she expanded the model to include other things like how many sandwich sales we make and how much inventory gets delivered. She's done all of this behind Coop's back because he didn't like anything written down. And at the end of the year, when he had to file papers with the government, he made Nora sign things with numbers she knew were wrong. I know it upset her. She always started smoking again if she was in the middle of trying to quit. She was the manager, and so the record keeping was her job and something she could get in trouble for if it wasn't right and the government ever came to check. I know that because they did fight about it, Nora and Coop. Just not yesterday. Yesterday, he fought with Janice. "Charlie," she says now, "do you know anything about that fight? Do you know anyone at the Triple S who'd want to hurt my husband?" She seems so sad about it. Not fake sad, but actually sad. Coop must have been so different with her. I can feel my mom's thoughts like they're being transported to my brain by telepathy. Regina Cooper doesn't seem to have a clue about the surveillance footage. No idea why I'm even here. Otherwise, she would have asked me a different question. I'm about to answer Regina Cooper, though. I still don't know how or what words to use when my mom saves me.
It's probably best if no one talks about the case. I mean, not that anyone has anything to hide, but just because it looks bad, like there's an effort being made to cover things up, you know? Like maybe influence is being used to get certain answers to be given or to be withheld. She lets this sink in. Then she finishes with, "I presume you're the new boss, right?" Regina hasn't considered this. We both see it by the surprise in her eyes. "Oh," she says, "I suppose you're right. I'm sorry, Charlie. I didn't mean to make you feel uncomfortable." My mom speaks for me again. "She's fine. Don't worry about my daughter." Regina gives us one of those smiles people use before they slink away, and I think this is over, but then she says, "I heard the detective saying you asked for a lawyer." My mom puffs up her chest like a male peacock. "Yes, well, my husband is a lawyer, so it shouldn't be a problem." Regina knows this, of course, which is exactly why she's brought it up. Regina is a snowflake that belongs here. "Well, if you need someone sooner, there's a woman in the lobby wearing a suit. I heard her say she was waiting for her client, so she's probably a lawyer. If she's just waiting around, maybe she can help you. Those lawyers are always looking for new clients, right? There's a reason they call them ambulance chasers." My mom gives her a Real Housewives laugh, then takes my hand and leads me back into the hall, where we head toward the lawyer who might be waiting there for an ambulance. As we walk, she tells me, "Do not ever trust that woman. Tell me you understand." And I nod and finally say a word, the only one my mom wants to hear. "Okay," I tell her. Chapter 8. Sawyer has a lot of stories that keep getting told. No one ever leaves to take them away, and no one new ever comes to dilute them. Some get bigger, some get smaller, and others just become part of the air we all have to breathe. There's just one story I know that connects my mom and Regina Cooper, and it goes back to their time in high school. Regina and Coop were seniors when my mom was a sophomore. That meant they spent 2 years at the same school, and the last one was a very bad year. The story about that year never gets smaller because it was the biggest scandal Sawyer has ever seen. Ian heard the story from his mother, and he told me in Keller. Ian's parents were also seniors that year, along with Coop and Regina. It happened on a field trip up in the mountains. It was an annual event for the senior class after exams were finished and they were getting ready for graduation. It was meant to celebrate the fact that they were moving on, although none of them really were. They just weren't going to school anymore. The students went to the same place every year, but once they arrived, some of the kids went on hikes, some swam in the river, others found places to be alone so they could drink and smoke and have sex, which is what teenagers like to do even when they're about to graduate. That very bad year, one group of boys went up a steep part of the trail. Coop was there. So was Ian's father, Cullen McGuire. There were a dozen other boys, but they had spread out into clusters, some moving faster, others slower. The cluster with Coop and Cullen McGuire also had a boy named Rudy Benton, who fell off the trail down the side of the mountain and died. According to Ian's mother, seeing Rudy fall to his death traumatized all the other boys, and they each found a different way to cope. One boy moved away right after graduation. His parents had the good sense to get him out of here. Mr. McGuire drank alcohol and sat around a lot, getting fired from multiple jobs and disappointing his family. And Coop? Well, they say that's how Coop got so mean. It's hard to believe that because it's hard to imagine him being any other way. But then again, Coop has given me one of the most important rules about human behavior. Rule number 24. No one is all good, and no one is all evil. This is what I mean. The summer I turned 14, I rode my bike down Highway 65, which is really just a four-lane road, stopping at every store and restaurant that didn't sell alcohol or tobacco, searching for a job.
The owners and managers all looked at me head to toe and scrunched their faces and pulled their heads back into their spines until their necks nearly disappeared the second I asked for an application. Like it was so absurd that they couldn't even comprehend the idea. Some let me fill out an application, but I could tell they were just going to throw it away. One lady at a bakery was honest about it. She said things were tough around here and other people needed jobs to support their families, while I had a family to support me. She also told me that I looked like a child still, like a girl, and it made people feel bad to see a child having to work. It made them feel like things were really, really bad, like in China, where they forced their children to work at barely 5 years old. People in America did not want to see themselves that way. I almost rode right past the Triple S because it was the next stop and what that woman said had made me cry. I needed to make money and I had no way to get it. Anger, frustration, hothead. I had my spreadsheet and I knew exactly how much I needed. My mom had agreed to open up an account for me at the bank. It's called a 529 and you don't have to pay taxes if you put money into it. She had to be on it as well, which annoyed me because it would be my money from my work, but you have to be 18 to have your own account. I would be in college by then if I got everything I needed. Federal loans, the town scholarship, money from a job in my 529. Dusty already told me he couldn't help. So unless money started falling from the sky, I needed all three of the things in my calculations. Dusty is another story, and not one that's even worth telling, except to say that I'm not his daughter, and there was an unspoken agreement that I could feel between him and my mom, that even after they got married, she would never expect him to treat me like one. It was set in stone, just like the rest of their lives together. He had to be a lawyer and make money, and she had to be a housewife and take care of everyone. I think there were other things that were more negotiable, like how much she had to look at him and whether she had to try to hide her repulsion, which she did less and less as he got more and more worthy of it. I think that people can get easier or harder to look at depending on how they behave over time. Dusty got harder to look at every single day. As I was riding past the Triple S that afternoon, I saw Nora sitting at a table on the side of the building smoking a cigarette. She was still wearing an apron from the lunch rush, but she looked dignified, proud. I must have stared at her for a long time because she finally looked up at me, and when she did, she smiled. It was the kind of smile you give someone who has just brought you a moment of happiness, maybe a memory from the past or a glimpse of hope for the future. I have wondered if what she saw in me reminded her of herself when she was a girl, or maybe just of girlhood itself. I never asked her. But it was enough for me to turn my bike into the parking lot and go inside. Clay Cooper was eating a sandwich and talking on the phone at a table in the back. I didn't know who he was at the time, but when I asked if they were hiring, the round, jovial woman behind the counter pointed him out. That was Janice, and she too smiled at me the way Nora did. Both of them smiling like that made me feel like I had found my new home, my new temporary home, until I could get out of here. She gave me a short application, which I filled out. Then I walked to where Clay Cooper was sitting in the dining room. "Sit," he told me, motioning at the bench across the table. I sat down and handed him my application and told him I was 14, legally able to work, and that I wanted a job to pay for college. All of this amused him and made him snicker at me. "Is this your full name, Charlie? It's not short for something?" "No. It's Charlie, just like I wrote it." His face grew curious. I was used to that. I'd been asked the same question my entire life, by teachers and doctors, even kids who usually don't care about things like that. My mother was 16 when she named me, and she was given two choices by her mother. Charlene, after my great-grandmother, or Eunice, after her great-aunt. Charlene it was, because as my mother later explained, she knew she could then call me Charlie. When we were finally on our own, my mother legally changed my name to erase everything about the past, which was just fine with me. I had always been Charlie, and from what my mom says, Charlene was not a nice woman. 14, huh? Coop looked at the resume I'd brought, which had my grades, SAT scores, the lists of classes I was taking, and of course, my race times. "You're a runner," he asked. "Not anymore," I answered. "That was true. That's another story." He looked up then. "Why not?" And I told him the truth. "It's not useful to me." "Not useful?" "Right? Not useful." He put the paper down and stared at me, no longer amused like I was a child, but curious, like I was a piece of information he'd just learned. "You're a little spitfire, aren't you?" He wasn't looking for an answer, so I didn't offer one. He stared a moment longer, long enough that I could smell the tobacco on the breath he was exhaling from across the table. He had a clean shave, but there was still something dirty about him. A shadow that never left his face. A bald spot on his head that was speckled with brown spots. The dark, thick hairs on his arms, which you could see when he rolled up the sleeves of his button-down shirt. Always a button-down, collared shirt, khaki pants, a belt, loafers, and even cologne. Coop did his best to look clean, but he just never did. "Okay," he said finally. "You're hired. Come on." I felt my eyes light up as I followed him into the service area, and then the prep room in the back, and then Nora's office, where she was then, seated at her desk, sorting through papers. My smile beamed as I took in the smells for the first time, the cleaning solution wafting up from a dirty mop bucket, the scraps of food spilled on the floor from the lunch rush, the peppers and the onions, and even the slight rot of the bad produce in the garbage that was bagged but hadn't been taken out yet. It entered my brain, making me feel things I couldn't control. But these things felt good, like I said before, like freedom. And for that brief moment, even though Clay Cooper was a dirty man inside and out, he was also my hero. As my mom talks to the lawyer we find in the lobby of the police station, my thoughts have gone in a straight line from Coop in high school seeing that boy die, becoming mean but still having some good about him, to the question Regina asked me in the bathroom about who would want to kill her husband. Then, obviously, the list begins to form in my mind. First, Janice. Coop fired her husband, Shane, from the tobacco store in town because Shane punched him in the face. Shane punched him in the face because Coop had called their son, Ollie, Half Pint, again, after they'd both asked him not to. Coop said Half Pint was a term of endearment and mentioned some show called Little House on the Prairie, which is so old it isn't even on Netflix. But to Shane and Janice, it was a reminder that Ollie was born sick, so his growth in all directions, up and out, was delayed, maybe forever. Bottom line, Coop knew any reference to Ollie's size was hurtful, and he made that comment anyway. He did it because he wanted to hurt them. He did it on purpose. It was no more complicated than that. This is another way I think of Clay Cooper. With one hand, he gave you a job. With another, he stole your dignity, your pride, your something or other. No matter the employee, with that second hand, he always took away the one thing that should be more valuable than money. But it can't be when you need to feed four children with one like Ollie, or when you need to pay for college or support your sick grandmother, or just because it was your life's work and there was nowhere else to go. Coop gave Shane his paycheck one day, and Shane said thanks a little too little and a little too late for Coop's liking. So Coop said, "How's Half Pint doing?" And Shane punched him right in the nose. A man has his limits. Shane went home and told Janice, who came into work the next day, both crying and yelling, because as much as she loved that her husband had defended their child, he had no right to do it, because what their child really needed were the doctors that job was paying for. "When do I get to punch someone?" she said that day to me and Nora and Keller and this new kid who only lasted a month because he couldn't even remember that a number 9 was a steak pita with American cheese.
He can lose his job over his manly pride, but what about my pride? What about my heart that breaks every time that son of a bitch calls my baby that name? When do I get to lose my shit? Janice then apologized for her French because Janice doesn't believe in swearing. She says it offends Jesus, and Janice believes in Jesus. She believes in a way you won't find on any of the billboards along the interstate that runs through our town. She believes from her nose to her toes. Nora nodded solemnly but said nothing because Janice was not wrong, so there was no point in trying to analyze the situation or make excuses for anyone. Not Coop or Shane. It just was what it was. Later that day, Janice begged Coop to take Shane back and swore he would never do that again, and then told him how hard it was with their son being so sick. And we don't really know what else she said as we watched from the service area while they sat in the dining area, but it was a lot. Coop leaned back with his arms folded, a man in control, a man with the power. And he made her beg and plead a good long time before he finally nodded his head yes. He got up with a straight back and a nod and a smile and walked to the prep room where he washed his dirty hands. Coop was good about Ollie for a while. He didn't mention him for almost 2 months, but then he just couldn't stand it. That was the thing with Coop. When he knew your weakness, he was like a kid holding a lollipop, its wrapper off, its sweet smell reaching up into his nose. He just had to lick it, just a tiny bit, just to get a taste. That was the part of him he couldn't control. Just like his greed and his lust, which is another story, he craved power, found it irresistible. I don't even remember what he said to Janice yesterday. I only know that he used half pint again, and this time Janice was just so filled up with rage, or maybe so empty of pride, that she couldn't stop herself. And like a breath that rushes in when you've tried to stop breathing, she called him every French word she could think of. She did it loud, and she did it in front of all of us in the prep room, and then she threw her green apron in the bin and slammed the back door on her way out. We all stood there, all except for Keller because she was working her second job at the diner, and we waited to see what would happen next. And what happened was surprising yesterday, but now makes perfect sense. Coop did what a person like him always does when you've bared your soul and let your weakness be known to them. He laughed. He laughed so hard, he buckled over and had to wipe tears from his eyes. Then he sighed and shook his head dismissively and told us the show was over and to get back to work. Did anyone want Clay Cooper dead? Well, Janice, for one.
Chapter 9. The lawyer in the lobby is a woman named Dana Blakely, and she wears a navy pantsuit and black pumps and has hair pulled into a tight bun at the back of her neck. There is not one single strand out of place and not one brown root showing, which is a sign that she takes very good care of herself and, by inference, will take very good care of me. She says she isn't a criminal lawyer, but deals with corporate matters. Dana Blakely says that she and the client she's waiting for are from the city, but he was held overnight on a DUI and she came here to get him released. She said she didn't mind talking with me until her client got out and she could drive him home. Then she tells us she charges $350 an hour and my mom chokes on her own breath. I wonder how we'll pay for it, but I imagine this is what it will cost Dusty for not finding us someone from his firm. A small price to pay to save him from the wrath of his wife. Dana Blakely and my mom go through the whole thing about the photos and how I was at the Triple S and maybe the body was moved and how I have a lopsided seesaw, and so while I might have seen something, I might not be capable of processing what I saw and talking about it without getting myself into trouble. When Dana Blakely agrees to help, my mom looks at me with satisfaction. "There," she says. "You see? Now we have a lawyer." There's no point reminding her that we'd have one for a lot less money if Dusty cared enough to help. My mom is great at conveniently forgetting things that would disrupt her denial of who Dusty really is inside. Like his refusing to co-sign on any private student loans for me because it would reduce his credit rating. And what if they need to refinance the house or get a car loan? Or refusing to take me off his tax returns as a dependent so I could maybe qualify for financial aid. Because he saves money when he claims me on his taxes and that money pays for the house and food. Sometimes I want to scare him by saying I won't go to college after all and will live in his house until some man decides to marry me. Dusty has said before that he worries about that, how no man will ever want to. He doesn't understand that just because I don't look like I'm listening, I still have ears that work perfectly fine. I almost say that we should thank Regina Cooper for telling us she saw this lawyer in the lobby, but then I decide to keep my mouth shut. I still don't know what the bad blood is between them. We find the detectives and show them our new attorney. They send me and my mom back to the same room where we wait while they speak with her. Dana Blakely, with the navy pantsuit. When she returns, she has a copy of the security footage, which we view on her laptop in the interview room. My eyes watch the 1 minute and 42 seconds of footage, but my mind is wandering back in time to the night before, with my people, my family, Nora and Janice and Keller and Levi and Ian and even the Triple S itself. Lettuce, tomatoes, pickles, onions. It spins with a decision that is now before me. Now that they know I was there but don't know what I saw, or even if I saw anything at all. The recording plays. I see myself come into view after leaving the bathroom. I'm about to enter the service area, but then I stop. I freeze. I hear something. And it causes me to drop to the floor and crawl around to the front of the store on hands and knees and hide behind the counter. I watch my mom's face. I see behind her skin to the ferocious instinct to protect her child as she watches me wince and then cover my ears on the screen. And then I watch the lawyer and see behind her veil a professionalism to something voyeuristic. Her base curiosity as she observes this skinny teenage girl in jeans and a t-shirt and a long brown ponytail start to crawl back to the entrance of the service area, then carefully lift her head just enough to try to see into the back room. There is no audio on the recording. The tape stops when I crawl into the service area, still on hands and knees, still trying to see something. For those few precious moments, I consider my entire life. My brain gets hot. My heart races. I tap my fingers together, together, left, right, left.